Section 5 of Trips to the Moon. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ralph Snelson. Trips to the Moon by Lucian of Samosata. Translated by Thomas Franklin. Section 5. The True History. Book 2. From this time our abode in the whale growing rather tedious and disagreeable, not able to bear it any longer, I began to think within myself how we might make our escape. My first scheme was to undermine the right-hand wall, and get out there, and accordingly we began to cut away, but after getting through about 5 stadia, and finding it was to no purpose, we left off digging, and determined to set fire to the wood, which we imagined would destroy the whale, and secure us a safe retreat. We began, therefore, by burning the parts near his tail. For 7 days and nights he never felt the heat, but on the 8th we perceived he grew sick, for he opened his mouth very seldom, and when he did, shut it again immediately. On the 10th and the 11th he declined visibly, and began to stink a little. On the 12th it occurred to us, which we had never thought of before, that unless, whilst he was gaping, somebody could prop up his jaws to prevent his closing them, we were in danger of being shut up in the carcass and perishing there. We placed some large beams, therefore, in his mouth, got our ship ready, and took in water and everything necessary. Cintharus was to be our pilot. The next day the whale died. We drew our vessel through the interstices of his teeth, and let her down from thence into the sea. Then, getting on the whale's back, sacrificed to Neptune near the spot where the trophy was erected. Here we stayed 3 days, it being a dead calm, and on the 4th set sail. We struck upon several bodies of the giants that had been slain in the sea-fight, and measured them with the greatest astonishment. For some days we had very mild and temperate weather, but the north wind arising, it grew so extremely cold that the whole sea was froze up, not on the surface only, but 300 or 400 feet deep, so that we got out and walked on the ice. The frost being so intense that we could not bear it, we put in practice the following scheme, which Cintharus put us in the head of. We dug a cave in the ice, where we remained for 30 days, lighting a fire and living upon the fish which we found in it. But our provisions failing, we were obliged to loosen our ship, which was stuck fast in, and hoisting a sail, slid along through the ice with an easy, pleasant motion. On the 5th day from that time it grew warm, the ice broke, and it was all water again. After sailing about 300 stadia, we fell in upon a little deserted island. Here we took in water, for ours was almost gone, killed with our arrows 2 wild oxen, and departed. These oxen had horns not on their heads, but as Momus seemed to wish, under their eyes. A little beyond this we got into a sea, not of water, but of milk, and upon it we saw an island full of vines. This whole island was one compact, well-made cheese, as we afterwards experienced by many a good meal which we made upon it, and is in length 25 stadia. The vines have grapes upon them which yield not wine but milk. In the middle of the island was a temple to the Nereid Galatea, as appeared by an inscription on it. As long as we stayed there, the land afforded us victuals to eat, and the vines supplied us with milk to drink. Tyro, the daughter of Salmonius, we were told, was queen of it, Neptune having, after her death, conferred that dignity upon her. We stopped 5 days on this island, and on the 6th set sail with a small breeze, which gently agitated the waves, and on the 8th changed our milky sea for a green and briny one, where we saw a great number of men running backwards and forwards, resembling ourselves in every part, except the feet, which were all of cork, whence, I suppose, they are called Phelopodes. We were surprised to see them not sinking, but rising high above the waves, and making their way without the least fear or apprehension. They came up to and addressed us in the Greek tongue, telling us they were going to Phello, their native country. They accompanied us a good way, and then, taking their leave, wished us a good voyage. A little after we saw several islands, amongst which to the left of us stood Fellow, to which these men were going, a city built in the middle of a large round court. Towards the right hand, and at a considerable distance, were many others, very large and high, on which we saw a prodigious large fire. Fronting the prow of our ship, we had a view of one very broad and flat, and which seemed to be about 500 stadia off. As we approached near to it, a sweet and odoriferous air came round us, such as Herodotus tells us blows from Arabia Felix. From the rose, the narcissus, the hyacinth, the lily, the violet, the myrtle, the laurel, and the vine. Refreshed with these delightful odors, and in hopes of being at last rewarded for our long sufferings, we came close up to the island. Here we beheld several safe and spacious harbors, with clear, transparent rivers rolling placidly into the sea, meadows, woods, and birds of all kinds chanting melodiously on the shore, and on the trees the soft and sweet air fanning the branches on every side, which sent forth a soft harmonious sound like the playing on a flute. At the same time we heard a noise, not of riot or tumult, but a kind of joyful and convivial sound, as of some playing on the lute or harp, with others joining in the chorus and applauding them. We cast anchor and landed, leaving our ship in the harbor, with Cintharus and two more of our companions. As we were walking through a meadow full of flowers, we met the guardians of the isle, who, immediately chaining us with manacles of roses, for these are their only fetters, conducted us to their king. From these we learned, on our journey, that this place was called the Island of the Blessed, and was governed by Rhadamanthus. We were carried before him, and he was sitting that day as judge to try some causes. Ours was the fourth in order. The first was that of Ajax Telamonius, to determine whether he was to rank with the heroes or not. The accusation ran that he was mad, and had made an end of himself. Much was said on both sides. At length Rhadamanthus pronounced that he should be consigned to the care of Hippocrates, and go through a course of hellebore, after which he might be admitted to the symposium. The second was a love affair, to decide whether Theseus or Menelaus should possess Helen in these regions, and the decree of Rhadamanthus was that she should live with Menelaus, who had undergone so many difficulties and dangers for her. Besides that, Theseus had many other women, the Amazonian lady and the daughters of Minos. The third cause was a point of precedency between Alexander, the son of Philip, and Hannibal the Carthaginian, which was given in favor of Alexander, who was placed on a throne next to the elder Cyrus, the Persian. Our cause came on the last. The king asked us how we dared to enter, alone as we were, into that sacred abode. We told him everything that had happened. He commanded us to retire, and consulted with the assessors concerning us. There were many in council with him, and amongst them Aristides, the just Athenian, and pursuant to his opinion, it was determined that we should suffer the punishment of our bold curiosity after our deaths, but at present might remain in the island for a certain limited time, associate with the heroes, and then depart. This indulgence was not to exceed 7 months. At this instant our chains, if so they might be called, dropped off, and we were left at liberty to range over the city, and to partake of the Feast of the Blessed. The whole city was of gold, and the walls of emerald. The 7 gates were all made out of one trunk of the cinnamon tree, the pavement within the walls of ivory. The temples of the gods were of beryl, and the great altars on which they offered the hecatombs all of one large amethyst. Round the city flowed a river of the most precious ointment, 100 cubits in breadth, and deep enough to swim in. The baths were large houses of glass perfumed with cinnamon, and instead of water filled with warm dew. For clothes they wore spiders' webs, very fine, and of a purple color. They have no bodies, but only the appearance of them, insensible to the touch and without flesh, yet they stand, taste, move, and speak. Their souls seem to be naked, and separated from them, with only the external similitude of a body, and unless you attempt to touch, you can scarce believe but they have one. They are a kind of upright shadows, only not black. In this place nobody ever grows old. At whatever age they enter here, at that they always remain. They have no night, no bright day, but a perpetual twilight. One equal season reigns throughout the year. It is always spring with them, and no wind blows but Zephyrus. The whole region abounds in sweet flowers and shrubs of every kind. Their vines bear 12 times in the year, yielding fruit every month. Their apples, pomegranates, and the rest of our autumnal produce, 13 times, bearing twice in the month of Minos. Instead of corn, the fields bring forth loaves of ready-made bread, like mushrooms. There are 365 fountains of water round the city, as many of honey, 500 rather smaller of sweet-scented oil, besides 7 rivers of milk, and 8 of wine. Their symposia are held in a place without the city, which they call the Elysian Field. This is a most beautiful meadow, skirted by a large and thick wood, affording an agreeable shade to the guests, who repose on couches of flowers. The winds attend upon and bring them everything necessary, except wine, which is otherwise provided, for there are large trees on every side made of the finest glass, the fruit of which are cups of various shapes and sizes. Whoever comes to the entertainment gathers one or more of these cups, which immediately becomes full of wine, and so they drink of it, whilst the nightingales and other birds of song, with their bills, peck the flowers out of the neighboring fields, and drop them on their heads. Thus they are crowned with perpetual garlands. Their manner of perfuming them is this. The clouds suck up the scented oils from the fountains and the rivers, and the winds, gently fanning them, distill it like soft dew on those who are assembled there. At supper they have music also, and singing, particularly the verses of Homer, who is himself generally at the feast, and sits next above Ulysses, with a chorus of youths and virgins. He is led and accompanied by Eunomus the Locrian, Arion of Lesbos, and Nacrian, and Stesichorus, whom I saw there along with them, and who at length is reconciled to Helen. When they have finished their songs, another chorus begins of swans, swallows, and nightingales, and to these succeeds the sweet rustling of the zephyrs that whistle through the woods and close the concert. What most contributes to their happiness is that near the symposium are two fountains, the one of milk, the other of pleasure. From the first they drink at the beginning of the feast. There is nothing afterwards but joy and festivity. I will now tell you what men of renown I met there. And first there were all the demigods, and all the heroes that fought at Troy, except Ajax the Locrian, who alone, it seems, was condemned to suffer for his crimes in the habitations of the wicked. Then there were the barbarians, both the Cyruses, Anacharsis the Scythian, Zamolxis of Thrace, and Numa the Italian. Besides these I met with Lycurgus the Spartan, Phocion, and Tellus of Athens, and all the wise men except Periander. I saw also Socrates, the son of Sophroniscus, prating with Nestor and Palamedes. Near him were Hyacinthus of Sparta, Narcissus the Thespian, Hylas, and several other beauties. He seemed very fond of Hyacinthus. Some things were laid to his charge. It was even reported that Rhadamanthus was very angry with him, and threatened to turn him out of the island if he continued to play the fool, and would not leave off his irony and sarcasm. Of all the philosophers, Plato alone was not to be found there, but it seems he lived in a republic of his own building, and which was governed by laws framed by himself. Aristippus and Epicurus were in the highest esteem here, as the most polite, benevolent, and convivial of men. Even Aesop the Phrygian was here, whom they made use of by way of buffoon. Diogenes of Sinope had so wonderfully changed his manners in this place that he married Lais the harlot, danced and sang, got drunk, and played a thousand freaks. Not one Stoic did I see amongst them. They, it seems, were not yet got up to the top of the hill of virtue, and as to Chrysippus, we were told that he was not to enter the island till he had taken a fourth dose of hellebore. The academicians, we heard, were very desirous of coming here, but they stood doubting and deliberating about it. Neither were they quite certain whether there was such a place as Elysium or not. Perhaps they were afraid of Rhadamanthus's judgment on them, as decisive judgments are what they would never allow. Many of them, it is reported, followed those who were coming to the island, but being too lazy to proceed, turned back when they were got halfway. Such were the principal persons whom I met with here. Achilles is had in the greatest honor among them, and next to him Theseus. 2 or 3 days after my arrival, I met with the poet Homer, and both of us, being quite at leisure, asked him several questions, and amongst the rest, where he was born, that, as I informed him, having been long a matter of dispute among us. We were very ignorant indeed, he said, for some had made him Chian, others a native of Smyrna, others of Colophon, but that after all he was a Babylonian, and amongst them was called Tigranes, though, after being a hostage in Greece, they had changed his name to Homer. I then asked him about those of his verses which are rejected as spurious, and whether they were his or not. He said they were all his own, which made me laugh at the nonsense of Xenodotus and Aristarchus the grammarians. I then asked him how he came to begin his Iliad with the wrath of Achilles. He said it was all by chance. I desired likewise to know whether, as it was generally reported, he wrote the Odyssey before the Iliad. He said no. It is commonly said he was blind, but I soon found he was not so, for he made use of his eyes and looked at me so that I had no reason to ask him that question. Whenever I found him disengaged, I took the opportunity of conversing with him, and he very readily entered into discourse with me, especially after the victory which he obtained over Thersites, who had accused him of turning him into ridicule in some of his verses. The cause was heard before Rhadamanthus, and Homer came off victorious. Ulysses pleaded for him. I met also Pythagoras the Samian, who arrived in these regions after his soul had gone a long round in the bodies of several animals, having been changed 7 times. All his right side was of gold, and there was some dispute whether he should be called Pythagoras or Euphorbus. Empedocles came likewise, who looked sodden and roasted all over. He desired admittance, but though he begged hard for it, was rejected. A little time after, the games came on, which they call here Thanatusia. Achilles presided for the 5th time, and Theseus for the 7th. A narrative of the whole would be tedious. I shall only, therefore, recount a few of the principal circumstances in the wrestling match. Carus, a descendant of Hercules, conquered Ulysses at the boxing match. Arius, the Egyptian, who was buried at Corinth, and Epeus contended, but neither got the victory. The Pancratia was not proposed amongst them. In the race I do not remember who had the superiority. In poetry, Homer was far beyond them all. Hesiod, however, got a prize. The reward to all was a garland of peacock's feathers. When the games were over, word was brought that the prisoners in Tartarus had broken loose, overcome the guard, and were proceeding to take possession of the island under the command of Phalaris the Agrigentine, Busiris of Egypt, Diomede the Thracian, Cyron, and Pidiocamptes. As soon as Rhadamanthus heard of it, he dispatched the heroes to the shore, conducted by Theseus, Achilles, and Ajax Telamonius, who was now returned to his senses. A battle ensued, wherein the heroes were victorious, owing principally to the valor of Achilles. Socrates, who was placed in the right wing, behaved much better than he had done at Delius in his lifetime, for when the enemy approached he never fled, nor so much as turned his face about. He had a very extraordinary present made him as the reward of his courage, no less than a fine spacious garden near the city. Here he summoned his friends and disputed, calling the place by the name of the Academy of the Dead. They then bound the prisoners and sent them back to Tartarus, to suffer double punishment. Homer wrote an account of this battle, and gave it to me to show to our people when I went back, but I lost it afterwards, together with a great many other things. It began thus: "Sing, Muse, the battles of the heroes dead." The campaign thus happily finished, they made an entertainment to celebrate the victory, which, as is usual amongst them, was a bean feast. Pythagoras alone absented himself on that day, and fasted, holding in abomination the wicked custom of eating beans. 6 months had now elapsed when a new and extraordinary affair happened. Cinyras, the son of Cintharus, a tall, well-made, handsome youth, fell in love with Helen, and she no less desperately with him. They were often nodding and drinking to one another at the public feasts, and would frequently rise up and walk out together alone into the wood. The violence of his passion, joined to the impossibility of possessing her any other way, put Cinyras on the resolution of running away with her. She imagined that they might easily get off to some of the adjacent islands, either to Phellus or Tyroessa. He selected three of the bravest of our crew to accompany them, never mentioning the design to his father, who he knew would never consent to it, but the first favorable opportunity put it in execution, and one night when I was not with them, for it happened that I stayed late at the feast and slept there, carried her off. Menelaus, rising in the middle of the night, and perceiving that his wife was gone, made a dreadful noise about it, and taking his brother along with him, proceeded immediately to the king's palace. At break of day the guards informed him that they had seen a vessel a good distance from land. He immediately put 50 heroes on board a ship made out of one large piece of the Asphodelus, with orders to pursue them. They made all the sail they possibly could, and about noon came up with and seized on them, just as they were entering into the Milky Sea, close to Tyroessa. So near were they to making their escape. The pursuers threw a rosy chain over the vessel, and brought her home again. Helen began to weep, blushed, and hid her face. Rhadamanthus asked Cinyras and the rest of them if they had any more accomplices. They told him they had none. He then ordered them to be chained, whipped with mallows, and sent to Tartarus. It was now determined that we should stay no longer on the island than the time limited, and the very next day was fixed for our departure. This gave me no little concern, and I wept to think I must leave so many good things and be once more a wanderer. They endeavored to administer consolation to me by assuring me that in a few years I should return to them again. They even pointed out the seat that should be allotted to me, and which was near the best and worthiest inhabitants of these delightful mansions. I addressed myself to Rhadamanthus, and humbly entreated him to inform me of my future fate, and let me know beforehand whether I should travel. He told me that after many toils and dangers I should at last return in safety to my native country, but would not point out the time when. He then showed me the neighboring islands, five of which appeared near to me, and a sixth at a distance. "Those next to you," said he, "where you see a great fire burning, are the habitations of the wicked. The sixth is the City of Dreams. Behind that lies the island of Calypso, which you cannot see yet. When you get beyond these, you will come to a large tract of land inhabited by those who live on the side of the earth directly opposite to you. There you will suffer many things, wander through several nations, and meet with some very savage and unsociable people, and at length get into another region." Having said thus, he took a root of mallow out of the earth, and putting it into my hand, bade me remember, when I was in any danger, to call upon that, and added, moreover, that if, when I came to the Antipodes, I took care never to stir the fire with a sword and never to eat lupins, I might have hopes of returning to the island of the blessed. I then got everything ready for the voyage, supped with them, and took my leave of them. Next day, meeting Homer, I begged him to make me a couple of verses for an inscription, which he did, and I fixed them on a little column of beryl at the mouth of the harbor. The inscription was as follows: "Dear to the gods and favorite of heaven, here Lucian lived, to him alone 'twas given. well pleased these happy regions to explore, and back returning seek his native shore. I stayed that day, and the next set sail, the heroes attending to take their leave of us, when Ulysses, unknown to Penelope, slipped a letter into my hand for Calypso at the island of Ogygia. Rhadamanthus was so obliging as to send with us Nauplius, the pilot, that if we stopped at the neighboring islands and they should lay hold on us, he might acquaint them that we were only on our passage to another place. As soon as we got out of the sweet-scented air, we came into another that smelt of asphaltus, pitch, and sulphur burning together with a most intolerable stench, as of burned carcasses. The whole element above us was dark and dismal, distilling a kind of pitchy dew upon our heads. We heard the sound of stripes and the yellings of men in torment. We saw but one of these islands. That which we landed on I will give you some description of. Every part of it was steep and filthy, abounding in rocks and rough mountains. We crept along over precipices full of thorns and briars, and passing through a most horrid country, came to the dungeon and place of punishment, which we beheld with an admiration full of horror. The ground was strewed with swords and prongs, and close to us were three rivers, one of mire, another of blood, and another of fire, immense and impassable, that flowed in torrents and rolled like waves in the sea. It had many fish in it, some like torches, others resembling live coals, which they called lychnissi. There is but one entrance into the three rivers, and at the mouth of them stood as porter Timon of Athens. By the assistance, however, of our guide Nauplius, we proceeded and saw several punished, as well kings as private persons, and amongst these some of our old acquaintance. We saw Cinyras hung up and roasting there. Our guides gave us the history of several of them, and told us what they were punished for. Those, we observed, suffered most severely who in their lifetimes had told lies, or written what was not true, amongst whom were Ctesias the Cnidian, Herodotus, and many others. When I saw these, I began to conceive good hopes of hereafter, as I am not conscious of ever having told a story. Not able to bear any longer such melancholy spectacles, we took our leave of Nauplius, and returned to our ship. In a short time after, we had a view, but confused and indistinct, of the island of dreams, which itself was not unlike a dream, for as we approached towards it, it seemed as it were to retire and fly from us. At last, however, we got up to it, and entered the harbour, which is called Hypnus, near the ivory gates, where there is a harbour dedicated to the cock. We landed late in the evening, and saw several dreams of various kinds. I propose, however, at present to give you an account of the place itself, which nobody has ever written about except Homer, whose description is very imperfect. Round the island is a very thick wood. The trees are all tall poppies, or mandragora, in which are a great number of bats, for these are the only birds they have here. There is likewise a river which they call Nyctiporus, and round the gate two fountains. The name of one is Negretos, and of the other Panicia. The city has a high wall, of all the colors of the rainbow. It has not two gates, as Homer tells us, but four, two of which look upon the plain of Indolence, one made of iron, the other of brick. Through these are said to pass all the dreams that are frightful, bloody, and melancholy. The other two, fronting the sea and harbor, one of horn, the other, which we came through, of ivory. On the right hand, as you enter the city, is the temple of Night, who, together with the cock, is the principal object of worship amongst them. This is near the harbor. On the left is the palace of Somnus, for he is their sovereign, and under him are two viceroys, Taraxian, the son of Mataogenes, and Plutocles, the son of Phantasion. In the middle of the marketplace stands a fountain, which they call Caryotis, and two temples of truth and falsehood. There is an oracle here at which Antiphon presides as high priest. He is inventor of the dreams, an honorable employment which Somnus bestowed upon him. The dreams themselves are of different kinds, some long, beautiful, and pleasant, others little and ugly. There are likewise some golden ones, others poor and mean, some winged and of an immense size, others tricked out, as it were, for pomps and ceremonies, for gods and kings. Some we met with that we had seen at home. These came up to and saluted us as their old acquaintance, whilst others, putting us first to sleep, treated us most magnificently, and promised that they would make us kings and noblemen. Some carried us into our own country, showed us our friends and relations, and brought us back again the same day. 30 days and nights we remained in this place, being most luxuriously feasted, and fast asleep all the time, when we were suddenly awaked by a violent clap of thunder, and immediately ran to our ship, put in our stores, and set sail. In 3 days we reached the island of Ogygia. Before we landed, I broke open the letter and read the contents, which were as follows. Ulysses to Calypso. This comes to inform you that after my departure from your coasts in the vessel which you were so kind as to provide me with, I was shipwrecked and saved with the greatest difficulty by Leucothea, who conveyed me to the country of the Phaeacians, and from thence I got home, where I found a number of suitors about my wife, reveling there at my expense. I destroyed every one of them, and was afterwards slain myself by Telegonus, a son whom I had by Circe. I still lament the pleasures which I left behind at Ogygia, and the immortality which you promised me. If I can ever find an opportunity, I will certainly make my escape from hence and come to you. This was the whole of the epistle, except that at the end of it he recommended us to her protection. On our landing, at a little distance from the sea, I found the cave as described by Homer, and in it Calypso, spinning. She took the letter, put it in her bosom, and wept, then invited us to sit down, and treated us magnificently. She then asked us several questions about Ulysses, and inquired whether Penelope was handsome and as chaste as Ulysses had reported her to be. We answered her in such a manner as we thought would please her best, and then, returning to our ship, slept on board close to the shore. In the morning, a brisk gale springing up, we set sail. For 2 days we were tossed about in a storm. The third drove us on the pirates of Colocynthus. These are a kind of savages from the neighboring islands who commit depredations on all that sail that way. They have large ships made out of gourds, 6 cubits long. When the fruit is dry, they hollow and work it into this shape, using reeds for masts, and making their sails out of the leaves of the plant. They joined the crews of 2 ships and attacked us, wounding many of us with cucumber seeds, which they threw instead of stones. After fighting some time without any material advantage on either side, about noon we saw just behind them some of the Carionata, whom we found to be avowed enemies to the Colocynthites, who on their coming up immediately quitted us and fell upon them. We hoisted our sail and got off, leaving them to fight it out by themselves. The Carionata were most probably the conquerors, as they were more in number, for they had 5 ships, which, besides, were stronger and better built than those of the enemy, being made of the shells of nuts cut in 2 and hollowed, every half-nut being 50 paces long. As soon as we got out of their sight, we took care of our wounded men, and from that time were obliged to be always armed and prepared in case of a sudden attack. We had too much reason to fear, for scarce was the sun set when we saw about 20 men from a desert island advancing towards us, each on the back of a large dolphin. These were pirates also. The dolphins carried them very safely, and seemed pleased with their burden, neighing like horses. When they came up, they stood at a little distance and threw dried cuttlefish and crab's eyes at us. But we, in return, attacking them with our darts and arrows, many of them were wounded, and unable to stand it any longer, they retreated to the island. In the middle of the night, the sea being quite calm, we unfortunately struck upon a halcyon's nest of an immense size, being about 60 stadia in circumference. The halcyon was sitting upon it, and was herself not much less. As she flew off, she was very near oversetting our ship with the wind of her wings, and as she went, made a most hideous groaning. As soon as it was day, we took a view of the nest, which was like a great ship and built of trees. In it were 500 eggs, each of them longer than a hogshead of Caius. We could hear the young ones croaking within, so with a hatchet we broke one of the eggs and took the chicken out unfledged. It was bigger than 20 vultures put together. When we were got about 200 stadia from the nest, we met with some surprising prodigies. A caniscus came, and sitting on the prow of our ship, clapped his wings and made a noise. Our pilot, Syntharus, had been bald for many years, when on a sudden his hair came again. But what was still more wonderful, the mast of our ship sprouted out, sent forth several branches, and bore fruit at the top of it, large figs and grapes, not quite ripe. We were greatly astonished, as you may suppose, and prayed most devoutly to the gods to avert the evil which was portended. We had not gone above 500 stadia farther before we saw an immensely large and thick wood of pines and cypresses. We took it for a tract of land, but it was all a deep sea, planted with trees that had no root, which stood, however, unmoved, upright, and, as it were, swimming in it. Approaching near to it, we began to consider what we could do best. There was no sailing between the trees, which were close together, nor did we know how to get back. I got upon one of the highest of them to see how far they reached, and perceived that they continued for about 50 stadia or more, and beyond that it was all sea again. We resolved, therefore, to drag the ship up to the top boughs, which were very thick, and so convey it along, which, by fixing a great rope to it, with no little toil and difficulty, we performed. Got it up, spread our sails, and were driven on by the wind. It put me in mind of that verse of Antimachus, the poet, where he says, "The ship sailed smoothly through the sylvan sea." We at length got over the wood, and, letting our ship down in the same manner, fell into smooth, clear water, till we came to a horrid precipice, hollow and deep, resembling the cavity made by an earthquake. We furled our sails, or should soon have been swallowed up in it. Stooping forward and looking down, we beheld a gulf of at least 1,000 stadia deep, a most dreadful and amazing sight, for the sea, as it were, was split in two. Looking towards our right hand, however, we saw a small bridge of water that joined the two seas, and flowed from one into the other. We got the ship in here, and with great labor rowed her over, which we never expected. From thence we passed into a smooth and calm sea, wherein was a small island with a good landing-place, and which was inhabited by the Bucephali, a savage race of men with bull's heads and horns, as they paint the Minotaur. As soon as we got on shore, we went in search of water and provision, for we had none left. Water we found soon, but nothing else. We heard, indeed, a kind of lowing at a distance, and expected to find a herd of oxen, but advancing a little farther perceived that it came from the men. As soon as they saw us, they ran after and took two of our companions. The rest of us got back to the ship as fast as we could. We then got our arms and determined to revenge our friends, attacked them as they were dividing the flesh of our poor companions. They were soon thrown into confusion and totally routed. We slew about 50 of them, and took two prisoners whom we returned with. All this time we could get no provision. Some were for putting the captives to death, but not approving of this, I kept them bound till the enemy should send ambassadors to redeem them, which they did, for we soon heard them lowing in a melancholy tone, and most humbly beseeching us to release their friends. The ransom agreed on was a quantity of cheeses, dried fish, and onions, together with four stags, each having 3 feet, two behind and one before. In consideration of this, we released the prisoners, stayed one day there, and set sail. We soon observed the fish swimming and the birds flying round about us, with other signs of our being near the land, and in a very little time after saw some men in the sea, who made use of a very uncommon method of sailing, being themselves both ships and passengers. I will tell you how they did it. They laid themselves all along in the water, They fastened to their middle a sail, and holding the lower part of the rope in their hands, were carried along by the wind. Others we saw sitting on large casks, driving two dolphins who were yoked together, and drew the carriage after them. These did not run away from, nor attempt to do us any injury, but rode around about us without fear, observing our vessel with great attention, and seeming greatly astonished at it. It was now almost dark when we came in sight of a small island inhabited by women, as we imagined, for such they appeared to us, being all young and handsome, with long garments reaching to their feet. The island was called Cabalusa, and the city Hydamardia. I stopped a little, for my mind misgave me, and looking round saw several bones and skulls of men on the ground. To make a noise, call my companions together, and take up arms, I thought would be imprudent. I pulled out my mallow, therefore, and prayed most devoutly that I might escape the present evil. And a little time afterwards, as one of the strangers was helping us to something, I perceived, instead of a woman's foot, the hoof of an ass. Upon this I drew my sword, seized on and bound her, and insisted on her telling me the truth with regard to everything about them. She informed me, much against her will, that she and the rest of the inhabitants were women belonging to the sea, that they were called Onus Ilias, and that they lived upon travellers who came that way. "We make them drunk," said she, "and when they are asleep, make an end of them." As soon as she had told me this, I left her bound there, and getting upon the house, called out to my companions, brought them together, showed them the bones, and led them in to her, when on a sudden she dissolved away into water, and disappeared. I dipped my sword into it by way of experiment, and the water turned into blood. We proceeded immediately to our vessel and departed. At break of day we had a view of that continent which we suppose lies directly opposite to our own. Here, after performing our religious rites and putting up our prayers, we consulted together about what was to be done next. Some were of opinion that, after making a little descent on the coast, we should turn back again. Others were for leaving the ship there, and marching up into the heart of the country to explore the inhabitants. Whilst we were thus disputing, a violent storm arose, and driving our ship towards the land, split it in pieces. We picked up our arms, and what little things we could lay hold on, and with difficulty swam ashore. Such were the adventures which befell us during our voyage at sea, in the islands, in the air, in the whale, amongst the heroes, in the land of dreams, and lastly amongst the Bucephali and the Onosilia. What we met with on the other side of the world shall be related in the ensuing books. End of section 5.